Wait up!
Yeah, you should keep up.
I'm Alex Hirsch, the voice of one Stan.
I'm Rob Renzetti, the voice of no Stans.
And I'm Matt Chapman, the musical interluderman.
So Matt's got a keyboard right now. I told him he was able to sample the word Stan, and I was like, how about you just hit that every time a character says Stan in this episode? But I'm starting to realize that like his keyboard will probably explode if he tries to do that.
Uh-oh, it's already malfunctioning.
So welcome to the Stan Brothers Childhood. This is A Tale of Two Stans, an episode that is a massive exposition dump. In this episode, basically...
Exposition dump.
We've been waiting for the entire series to know what's Stan's story, what's his backstory, and we knew that... You know, it was always, we had planned this whole season that, okay, midway through the season, that's when we're going to learn this, we're going to meet Ford, we're going to discover Stan's backstory, and the entire purpose of this is that Stan and his brother have had this huge rivalry that remains to this day and threatens to tear apart Dipper and Mabel, and briefly does, and then Dipper and Mabel are able to find their way together, which is meant to repair Stan and his brother's past. But in order to do this, we had to fill in the gaps of his past, we had to figure out how it all worked, and this was... a real tough episode to write. We did many, many drafts of this. In particular, this scene. Ford was a very difficult character to figure out because we knew that all I knew about him when I started the series, I always knew Stan had a twin, but all I knew about Ford from the jump was that he's everything Stan isn't. So Stan is a guy with a huge chip on his shoulder. He's kind of a loser at life. There's somebody who... is a winner at life, or at least was a winner in all these ways. Stan! Was a winner in all these ways that Stan wasn't. But we weren't sure what his personality would be at first, and there was a lot of different versions. I don't know if you remember. Alonzo did a version of him where he was kind of like this hippie. He had a long beard.
Yeah.
It was sort of like Arrested Development, those identical twins.
There was also the inclination to go for the pure scientist, kind of more nerdy... thing which we
where he's just Mr. Poindexter.
Yeah.
You shoved me in a dimension. I don't care for that.
Yeah.
And we realized that, you know, in order to bring out the maximum amount of frustration in Stan, he needed to have a bit of a heart. Like here we see him being kind to the kids. He's not all bad, which is what's so infuriating to Stan. The idea that he would quickly get along with the kids when he can't get any respect from this guy. Sort of Ford is designed for what would bring out the most amount of conflict in the family. What would be Dipper's hero? What would be Stan's rival? And who's somebody that we could empathize with everyone in their take of how they felt about him?
I mean, hard to empathize with a character that comes out and punches one of the fan's favorite characters in the face, basically before he almost says anything. But that was what's so hard about this scene was trying to. We knew we had to start somewhere like that.
Yeah,
and I know that was the goal. We not only juggled dialogue, we juggled the order of all this stuff. We went back and forth.
Many different versions. There was a version where Ford quickly. You know, you spit out of the portal and then a monster chases him. He blasts the tentacles off the monsters, saves the kids. There was a version where the agents get down here and Ford immediately subdues all the agents.
Right,
and
then to get them out of the way.
And then this whole episode is him telling his life story with them up in the living room. And there were some really funny scenes. I remember there was a scene where he's like, oh, well, it'll be nice to see my shack after all these years. Hope you haven't done anything to it. And he sees the gift shop, and he sees, you know, his face. Like, Stan has, like, a burp in Stanford Pine stall. And we ended up putting a lot of that stuff in the journal because it was very funny to me thinking about how horrified Stanford would be with what Stan's done with his lab. But ultimately, we felt like it didn't seem plausible that they would just pause to tell everyone their life story if they weren't trapped somewhere.
Yeah.
And that was sort of the format that we used to make, you know, what is essentially a bottle episode. Atomic Age brings giant corn. That's definitely a Josh Weinstein joke.
Yeah, this was like perfect for him. He had so many good things. I remember there's at one point one of the like kid bullies says one side as he like pushes past somebody, and I was like, man, that's like the only a Josh joke. Like he has such a mastery of like the little rascals sort of world.
Yeah, Josh Weinstein, who was one of the writers on this episode, like really keyed into like sort of nostalgia and nostalgia slang. You know, our artists did a lot of Ian in particular. you know, he's the art director and he often doesn't have time to draw or paint backgrounds himself. But that shot of their room, like
that was all him.
That's an Ian exclusive. And, you know, he designed the Mystery Shack. He designed Dipper and Mabel's room. And there is... there's exquisite details in there. The sort of Mad Magazine style magazine, you know, the Davy Crockett cap. Like, he's really figuring out, like, what kind of kids are they? You know, the sort of the era, the sort of late 50s, early 60s kind of vibe.
Well, it's great because you also see that at this age, that all the stuff that would cross over that would appeal to both of them. You know, it's not just like, oh, there's science stuff here.
Yes.
And then there's, like, I don't know what little, like, you know, Stan would be into. But, like, it's like, no, they both like all this.
There's so many hidden Easter eggs in this where, like, you know, his house is next to, hot Belgian waffles, which is something he yells, hot Belgian waffles! Like, this idea that, like, Stan's dumb things that he yells. That mask, that monster mask that's in his room is the mask that he scares Dipper with in the very first episode. And there's also some inside jokes in here. Cram Pelter is I think on Matt Chapman's office it said Cram Pelter Associates.
They wouldn't put a name tag next to my office, so I made my own and just said Cram Pelter in accounting.
Does Cram Pelter come from somewhere, or did you just make that up out of your beautiful head?
It's probably the name of like a home network or a Linksys router in my house at some point in my life.
This first act was the hardest act to write because we needed to sort of suggest an entire life and find the right details. And we went through very many different versions. There was a version where they were not as good friends. There was a version where, a lot of different ideas that we came up with to suggest, you know, what was the moment where things started to change between them, where they went from best friends. And it felt, as we went through drafts, that the right moment would be sort of as they're entering the end of high school and they have to make a choice about college and the rest of their lives and they're speaking to guidance counselors, that's when the world at large is pointing out, by the way, one of you is amazing. And the toll that would take on Stan. I remember, this is very sort of personal to me, when I was in elementary school, I remember the worst day of elementary school was discovering that three of my best friends had we'd all taken a test together and they'd been filtered into the gifted class and I hadn't. And these were like my friends. It wasn't like, oh, these are some nerds that I can make fun of them. These are the guys I hang out with and I'm the only one who wasn't filtered in, and they all have this special book, Parents' Guide to Dealing with Gifted Kids, and I had Hungry Caterpillar. And, you know, so, like, I know how Stan feels in this scene when somebody comes in and says, like, you know what, there was a race you didn't know you were running, and you're already behind.
Yeah, way behind.
Way behind. And, you know, even though Stan is a guy who looks like he's having a fun time, I always, in my gut, thought of him as somebody who is a huge well of sadness, a loss of human connection, and that need to please, that trying to get laughs from the crowd and, you know, constantly telling dumb jokes and, you know, putting on a big show in the Mystery Shack. Like, he's trying to get from them the affection that he never got from his family and lost with his brother.
Oh, jeez.
It's pretty... Matt, do you have any particular memories of some of the just other alternate versions of this, dead ends, changes we made?
There was one version where the climax was at a dance, right? Weren't they both going to take girl to the dance?
Yeah.
I can't remember if it was...
We
was it Carla
a version
McCorkle,
of that.
The one from several times? I can't remember if it's the same girl.
Oh, right, if it was Carla McCorkle. Carla Hot Pants McCorkle. We briefly explored the, you know, a woman comes between them, but it felt like it's sort of inventing a female character just for the sake of that role, and it felt like it wasn't deep enough.
It wasn't deep enough.
There's a footbot there. You'll notice Stan made footbot originally as his terrible science fair project, and that's why he dreams of, thank you for building me, Daddy.
There was also a version where early on, I remember Stan, they like rigged the school water fountain or something. Remember that? Like, they did sort of like a caper, but like it was a and a scam caper together.
Yeah,
when they were in elementary school, but we decided to save the science for for the science fair stuff.
Yeah, yeah. We played around with the idea that you would see them working together, doing little science games or pulling little pranks. There was actually a scene that I think some of it was even storyboarded where they have a treehouse and they're in a treehouse together and Cram Pelter and friends have tracked them down and are begging for their lunch money, and Stan and Ford have used, you know, their jerkiness and geniusness to rig up like a water balloon throwing machine that knocks Cram Pelter in the head. I remember him saying, "Oh no, my old timey paper crown." We're really hanging a lampshade on all these sort of little rascal cliches. As many sort of dated references here, Stan being like, "Oh, Jackie O, what a fox." Like, I don't, you know, I'm not sure it all quite lines up timeline wise.
I tried to make it line up as much as
Rob
it
is the timeline
sense.
Guy. Whenever there's a question about dates and numbers and ages and years, I would defer to Rob and just say, "All right, tell me what it is, and I won't worry about it."
Well, you know,
you can put the macrame owl on the wall. Technically, that's maybe 2 or 3 years early, but I guess there would have been some outliers that would have had those already at that point.
I got to give a shout out. This is Jonathan Banks. I mentioned in a previous commentary that I was watching a lot of Breaking Bad. This is Mike the Fixer from Breaking Bad. Walter, you
He's
idiot.
Great. Perfect.
You
perfect ignoramus. Casting for these two.
I was so just all fingers crossed that he would come and do Philbrick Pines, and of course he was instantly perfect.
Yeah.
And I remember him looking at the script and he's like, "Oh, like my real knucklehead sons." Like it was 100% not acting for him. He was exercising some demons with this role.
J.K. Simmons, of course, the voice of Ford, also amazing, and doing a good younger version of himself too in this episode. He's just amazing.
J.K. Simmons, hugely versatile. One read wonder. As soon as he picked up this script, he just nailed it. And, you know, I was a little worried at first because it was hard figuring out what should Stan's twin sound like. You know, it was possible that it would just be me doing a different version of Stan. It was possible that we'd have a wildly different voice. And I was a little worried that, you know, a guy in his mid-20s who's not very good at acting, and J.K. Simmons, an Academy Award-winning adult man, doing voices next to each other wouldn't be plausible. But I feel like the attitudes are just believable enough that you can, if not believe it, you can feel it, you know?
Yeah, that speaks to both of your strengths, I think, that you guys make that work.
I think it speaks more to the power of animation, that people will believe whatever comes out of the cartoon character's mouth. these gags of Sham Total.
Yeah, this is one of my wife's favorite parts of this episode. She was laughing with delight at all this.
A lot of these were jokes that I had from way back when I pitched the series. I had come up with an idea that Stan had a long history of these terrible scam products, and I made a big list of them. Probably my favorite joke in the episode that ended up getting cut for time was a Josh Weinstein joke a minute ago where Stan's driving off and the line was something to the effect of, "I drove off into that 1970s New Jersey night like, well, there really aren't any words or songs to describe it." Like, it was some kind of just like perfect Bruce Springsteen joke that like would go over the heads of 90% of our audience. But it was such a great joke. And just ultimately, this episode is way longer than our usual episodes. I begged the studio, please let us have some extra time on this one. We have an entire life that we need to fit in 21 minutes. And they let us stretch it to, I think, 23 minutes or something. But it was very, very difficult to convince them.
Wrote a thesis that was nationally ranked and was awarded an enormous grant for my own scientific research. But what to study? My whole life I'd been teased for my six fingers.
Here we see Tesla and Carl Sagan. I imagine
Sagan is great.
Ford's reason for having the red turtleneck was inspired by Carl Sagan, who I was obsessed with.
Well, another thing about this episode is the decision, like, when do you go into montage and when do you do a real-time scene?
Yes, and when is it Stan's story and when is it Ford's story? It's like just a lot of figuring out. And there's definitely, you know, after sort of solving the whole series, there's certain things about this episode that if I could go back and sort of adjust them to kind of streamline and strengthen, there's things that I would. But I was so impressed with, I feel like the crew did such a great job. Like the artists did a great job. Like our writers did a great job. Like J.K. Simmons did such a great job. I think they really sort of elevate all the sort of ideas here.
Was this the episode where Stephanie Ramirez did the like lineup of the stands?
Yes.
Their various ages. Like,
huge shout out to Stephanie Ramirez, one of our character designers, amazing designer, designed the ghost in Northwest Mansion, designed the unicorn in Mablecorn, and she did a very complicated lineup of all Stan and his brother throughout the ages, all the costumes they wear, all them changing their hairstyles, them changing, very difficult to track. And I also made the decision when I looked at her designs, they didn't match the way we had seen Stan's face in Dreamscapers.
Yeah.
But they were better. And I was just like, you know, this tells the story better. I'm gonna be willing to retcon for this because she did such a good job, and it tells this story really well.
Just going to ignore that. There were anomalies everywhere, and the more I looked, the more
this sequence storyboarded by Sabrina Coutinho did such a good job of, we're trying to at this point really just kind of make it just kind of a love letter to the series up until this point, like reference every little mystery. Here we're trying to tee up those floating cliffs that we're going to pay off in Dipper and Mabel versus the Future. Is that, I think that's a Josh Weinstein joke. Is that a Weinstein joke or a Matt joke?
Which Shmebulog Senior?
Yeah, no, I think that's Josh.
I think that's Josh. This is one of the very few paintings that Ian was able to do himself and freeze frame it, go through that. It's maybe my favorite painting in the entire show. All the amazing little details inside Ford's room.
I decided to call up my old college buddy, Fiddleford McGucket.
And this is all definitely this is all Josh Weinstein. The idea that McGucket was basically Steve Jobs, that he probably would have become the founder of like the biggest computer company in the world if he hadn't taken that fateful phone call. And it was also kind of Josh's, the idea that he would waffle between sort of hog farmer lingo and genius scientist lingo was very Josh and really cute.
He can't help but spit in a spittoon. Like, that's just what his family did. It doesn't matter how
family tradition
he gets.
I think that was our director, Sunil, who added that little baby cute biker. Very cute.
Ready? And... What?
And so here we're kind of connecting a lot of different pieces. Sort of, this is meant to show sort of what it was that McGucket needed to erase, what it was that drove him to madness. It was partially seeing the Nightmareverse and the way it messed with his head, and also partially just realizing that this thing has apocalyptic consequences, and he doesn't want to be a part of it, and if he can't destroy it or talk Ford out of something, he can forget about it. Because that's, you know, if Ford's weakness is pride, McGucket's weakness is weakness, you know? McGucket's weakness is he's got a kind heart, and he can't bring himself to, he can't stop people, he can't destroy things.
I mean, he should have basically knocked Ford out and destroyed the, you know, tied him up.
Yeah, he should have beat Ford with a wrench and taken this thing apart piece by piece. He's the one who understood how to build it, but, you know, he's, I think, somebody else who doesn't have a lot of, I think he's kind of a follower, and I think he's the kind of person who could get suckered in by a cult leader. You know, he's the kind of person looking for instruction, and he really respects Stan and can't bring himself to...
He's like, I just got out of a bunker. I don't want to go work for another guy down in another bunker. This is my third doomsday cult this year. you did a great job, I think, of doing civilized McGucket, like pre-going completely bananas McGucket. I thought that was good, where it still sounds like him. You can hear him in there. And then especially in that, it's in Society of the Blind Eye, I think, where you had to morph him over the course of that videotape. Was pretty amazing.
It's difficult. It was definitely, I mean, it's tough, because McGucket's speaking voice is basically just my voice with a sort of slight, kind of crummy Southern accent. I wanted to get Jack McBrayer for young McGucket, but somehow it wasn't in the cards. It might have been difficult to get those pieces to fit together.
Wasn't he doing Wander Over Yonder down the hall anyway?
I know, right? It should have been
easy. Hey, come down here, give us some peanuts.
Take a look at the background. There we see Stan safe in a button for the trapdoor referenced in Little Gideon. That T-Rex skull that Stan uses as an end table used to be hooked up to a bunch of electrodes inside a tank. Everything here is figured out to sort of explain how this was originally a lab before it was turned into a kooky Ripley's Believe It or Not. And I thought the artist just did such a wonderful job. And that shack in the snow is meant to reference Land Before Swine, yep. where we see what should be a young Stanford Pines, even though, again, the design's a little off. But we knew big sideburns, bushy hair, although that Stanford looked a little bit more swole than this guy.
And that's one of the what we thought were very subtle clues in season one that helped a lot of fans figure everything out
way too soon. We reached a moment when a subset of our fans had solved the mystery and we had a choice. You know, do we try to outsmart them? Do we try to change it? And ultimately we decided, no, we stick to our story, the one we believe in. It's the one that brings out what we need in the characters.
Yeah.
You know, I tried to troll people with a little bit of a misdirect as a sort of experiment. But ultimately we stuck to the plan of what our story was going to be, even as we discovered new details like what Ford's personality would be and exactly how their rift was formed.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people maybe think that what they're really watching a show for, especially a mystery show, is all the answers. But they're really not. What they're watching it for is the characters that they love. And if you change the answer to the mystery but betray your characters, you're not doing anybody any good.
Yeah,
you're just making a worse show.
It was important to us that this would be... That we tried to arrange, and we didn't always nail it, but it was our effort to arrange stories in a way that brought out the maximum sort of friction and pathos in our characters.
You left me behind, you jerk! It was supposed to be us forever! You ruined my life!
You ruined your own life! Stanley! Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry! Are you all right? Ow!
This idea that Stan's tattoo was actually a burn, burned on a symbol from one of these strange items, is something we actually had very early on.
Yeah.
In retrospect, the idea that the symbol is on the side of that panel versus connected to something else, I'm like, that's a little weird that something that hot would just be there. I probably, if I could make an adjustment, I'd probably stick it on a different part of a machine.
Well, didn't we joke about putting a sign next to it? Like, this is very hot.
There is a sign on it that says caution.
But
Ford's a pretty practical guy. I think he'd be too smart to do that. But yeah. one of his mistakes.
Well, he was in a rush.
It was one of those subcontractors that built the bunker as well.
That's right.
And I love the way this section is boarded. Just Stan has been waiting for years to have a reunion with his brother. He's always felt like a screw-up. Stan, once again, had an idea of how he thought things were going to go. He thought that his brother was saying, I need your help for the first time. He's going to go up there. They're going to have some drinks. They're going to catch up. And instead, he ended up shoving his brother into another dimension. And running out of food and money. It's sort of his worst nightmare. But this was Stan's entire character from the very beginning of the series was built around this idea that he's living with this tragedy. He's a guy who outwardly seems like he doesn't appreciate family, but in fact wants it more than anything in the world and feels like maybe he's not worthy of it and would do anything to prove that he is. There we see a young Chandra Jimenez. We get to see
among others.
Ma and Pa again. It was a lot of fun to visit these characters, see young designs of Lazy Susan.
I like getting to see just Gravity Falls in the winter, too, which was always a bummer making this summer show where we were always like, can there be an episode where it just snows for no reason? Just to try and make a winter
episode.
Yeah,
we tried to
figure
that out a couple
times. It was fun to get to see the town like that.
We had to make the most of it. No, it's my eternal regret that we never could excuse seeing Gravity Falls in autumn because fall is my favorite season, and there's just a spooky feeling in the air.
Oh, a Stan... Ford. Stanford.
Another great layout right here. Freeze frame. Look at this background. The way that the gift shop was originally just a storage room filled with just strange things from from Ford's investigations, and some of them stayed and some of them left. This whole scene where Stan does his first tour, I almost cut this out because the network was really desperate to cut time out of the episode, but this seeing Stan figure out what he's good at felt important to me.
Yeah.
Like, he's never been good at anything in his life, and he makes a stupid hokey joke, and it suddenly turns into a profit. I felt like without that, I was missing something in understanding why he would do this, how this would be the solution to his problem.
For once in my life, people were actually buying what I was selling. And so the murder hut was born.
The murder hut? That's a Matt Chapman joke. Always
hey,
cracks me up.
Fantastic.
Cheat paid off. The old me was dead.
and I faked it.
In the scratch track for this episode, the original music cue was the 80s song Our House in the Middle of Our Street.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because it's just got this really, like, cheery opening. Yeah, there it is. we couldn't get the rights to it.
I mean, I like the music that we have there. And,
yeah, Brad does an amazing job.
It might have taken us out of the show reality a little bit to have.
I like that it was like the mid '80s though. Like it was specific to the.
It was
Stan's memories.
It was era appropriate.
Yeah.
The agents are coming for us.
What do we do?
Oh man, I was so spellbound by your dramatic tale, I forgot all about those dudes.
Wait, forget. That's it. I think I know a way we might be able to defeat those agents.
So this is definitely a situation where, you know, the agents were basically designed as a way to catalyze all these issues with our characters, but we didn't really factor them into our finale. We didn't really want to see them again. We didn't feel that there was a lot that they could bring to the drama. Now needed to be internal, not external, within our family. And having them just sort of float around felt like it wasn't useful. But we'd written ourselves into a corner because we liked them and we needed them. And this was something where we realized we could kill a few birds with one stone. One, we'd already set up memory guns. And, you know, we need to show that Ford's really awesome. And so we could get rid of the agents, show that Ford can pretty much handle anything that Stan can't, and also call back to our memory ray all in one. So I think it worked well enough. It's definitely a deus ex machina, but I think I'll excuse it for what it says about Ford's character.
And if that's the price you paid to get to watch this awesome flashback episode, I think that's worthy.
Yeah. The price is the convenience of this conclusion tax that you have to pay. Also, this idea that they would just give him literally everything on one thumb drive doesn't make a ton of sense. But you know, on a TV show where you can own a house by stealing the deed, I'm willing to forgive that as well.
I did enjoy Ford asking for their 8-track tapes, though. I enjoyed.
Did it remind you of your day, Rob?
It does. What do you mean, remind me of? I've got my collection at home.
We would ask Rob about
Pop Blue Oyster Cult in the 8-track player on my way home from here tonight.
What were those 70s like, Rob? tell me a tale.
They were a glorious time.
Funny hit the hay, huh?
It's the author. I've been waiting so long to ask questions about Stan.
Ah, yes, that's it. That's the 70s I remember.
Oh, I lost my Stan.
Stan!
Stan!
I like this little squeeze Wendy. We could never figure out how to get Wendy in on all this stuff that had happened.
We wanted to think of a way to get her in there, and it didn't quite fit, so we were able to put her in the tag, which I think was a great solution. This whole ending from here up until the end of the episode, I'm really happy with the way that we played this, where, you know, Ford's not a villain. He's not coming out here straight up. You know, he's getting in Stan's face and saying, I want my life back. But hopefully by the end of the episode, even though you don't root for his perspective, you understand his perspective, where it's like Stan ruined his science project. Stan shoved him into the portal. Stan took over his house. He's not completely unreasonable to want it back. And he's not completely unreasonable about his request. He says, okay, you've got till the end of the summer. And Stan's little look there tells you everything you need to know about how he feels about the situation. And here we're teeing up the rest of the conclusion of the series, which is just, whoa, this is different. The status quo is shifted, and is it going to shift us? And that was the mission of this entire story, was shift things such that it pits Dipper and Mabel against each other so that they can ultimately make things right and fix their uncle's trauma in the process.
I always feel like you did almost too good of a job of making, or like we all did, of, I kind of always rooted for Ford. Like sometimes I'd be like, I just like hate Stan and be like, oh yeah, I'm supposed to love Stan more. Like I found myself unreasonably on Ford's side.
Because there was sort of a war within the fan community after this episode aired between people who loved Ford and thought that it was Stan's fault and Ford deserves, more support, and people who hated Ford. And I love all the characters of the show, even characters like Pacifica. I'm like, oh, I hate this character. Like, there are children, you know, like when you have a problem with them, it's still tough love.
Well, that means hit the right note if there was a division in the community, because they're both right. They're both wrong.
If everyone's mad, you did a good job.